Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And about this time of year, every year, we turn to examining, trying, sampling, and talking about food products. And we have some interesting ones to bring to you. There's always something. It's a very fast-paced industry. Specialty food is really what we're talking about. And we're going to start off with Justin Rashid and his wonderful company, American Spoon, which puts into focus one of the most underrated states of the union, Michigan. All this miraculous jarred food has been arriving in our door, and I am just so smitten with it. It's from a company called American Spoon. And we're going to be finding out more about it, talking to co-founder Justin Rashid. Justin Rashid is how you pronounce it. You were co-founder with Larry Forgione, Chef Larry Forgione, which probably accounts for a little bit of the name and the style of the food. Your location in northern Michigan and your childhood foraging really is the basis of this operation, isn't it?
Well, yes, to a large degree. But had I never met Larry, probably the company would not have happened.
Well, tell us about how this happened.
Well, back in the late 70s, after a mercifully brief career in the theater, my wife and I moved back to northern Michigan, which is the scene of all my childhood summers, and we opened a little business along the road, selling local produce. And every morning we'd go out to the farms and bring things in and display them under an awning. And one of our really serendipities behind the start of the company, because one of our customers there moved to New York to become a dancer. And as you know, when you move to New York to become a performer, you usually end up working in a restaurant. And she did. And the restaurant was the River Cafe, where she was a server, a waitress, and the next summer she came back and she said, you know, this really intense chef at this restaurant where I work made me promise that I would find someone in northern Michigan to pick some kind of mushroom for him, and I completely forgot. He's going to be really upset with me. And I said, no, your problem solved. He wants morels, and I've been picking him since I was 13, so give me his number and I'll send him mushrooms. So that's how Larry and I got together, and I sent him a shipment of black morels, and he called back right away, and he picked them up at LaGuardia. He said, these are the most beautiful morels I've ever seen. Send all you can pick, and what else do you have? And so that began a relationship where I would forage things that I knew about, and Larry would call me looking for things that he'd heard about, be it, you know, hickory nuts or ramps or... we had a dozen different varieties of fall mushrooms that we pick here. And so that was really the beginning of the relationship, really one of a forager and a chef who was becoming very well known for having these wonderful things on the menu. So then we had the idea that I had a friend out here named Jerry Olson, who had one of the largest, he had the largest buffalo herd east of the Mississippi, and that's a whole other story. But I said, Larry, you want to be the great American chef, you have to have the great American meat. You need to get some buffalo on the menu. And there's a gentleman out here who has about 800 buffalo, and I'll talk to him. So that began a reason for Larry to come out. I said, you know, he needs to meet with you, so can you come out? And Larry flew into Northern Michigan. I guess it was a day in early summer of 1980, and I was driving him down from the airport to Traverse City, where the Buffalo Ranch was, and he kept looking out the window, and he said, you know, being a typical New Yorker, never been to the Midwest, didn't really know the geography, he said, we've been passing the same water for an hour. What is this? Is this a lake or is this a river? What is this? And I said, well, no, it's a lake. He said, how big is it? I said, it's very big. He called it one of the Great Lakes.
He didn't even know.
It's called Lake Michigan. I said, really, how big is it? I said, well, you know, Chicago is 350 miles that way, and Wisconsin is 100 miles across. He said, amazing. And he said, one more question. What are all these? He said, I see all the forest, but then we pass these places where the trees are growing in perfect rows. I said, well, Larry, those are orchards. This is one of the premier microclimates for fruit culture in the world, and we grow, you know, cherries and apples and pears and plums and peaches and apricots. And the very next thing out of his mouth was, really, can you make jam? And I said, well, yeah, I grew up with a mom who made jam. I'm on a raspberry farm. I'm sure I can make jam. Just send me a recipe, and I'll find the fruit, and we'll make jam. So we were both 29 years old and young and dumb, and we didn't think there would be anything to it. And he wanted jam because he did a huge brunch business at the River Cafe at that time. And he wanted to serve a great American fruit preserve. And he felt there wasn't one. And he didn't want to use imported preserves. And so that was our mission, to make the best preserves in the world from Michigan fruit. And he called and gave me a recipe for strawberry preserves. And I went looking from farm to farm and found this early glow strawberry, which is a fabulous variety of strawberry. It has all the bouquet of a wild strawberry. It's a very small berry. And we got a copper kettle and went into a basement of a candy store and that we rented, and we started to make jam.
Wow.
And that's how we began.
Now, this is Michigan, guys. Listen carefully. This is the home of Detroit and Grand Rapids and kind of wonderful places. And then it has this place that's kind of like the frozen north.
People don't really understand the microclimate that we're in, but Lake Michigan creates it, and northern Michigan, of course, is very, very different from southeastern Michigan, where most of the cars in America are made. But
people who come to northern Michigan
are shocked.
Yeah, I went to school in Ann Arbor, so I know about. I mean, half the people in my class were from Traverse City, you know.
Okay. There is a great relationship between Ann Arbor and Traverse City.
Yeah. So, but anyhow, this was 33 years ago, right?
33 years ago. We incorporated in June of 1982. So this was about 35 years ago that Larry and I started making jam. But not as a company. I just started to, set things up. And we didn't really formally incorporate until June of 1982.
Well, you make a whole lot more than just jam, although that's still handcrafted fruit preserves are still your main product, but also condiments. I told you I'm in love with the chili jam. What's in that?
Well, the chili jam is mostly Fresno peppers, and that's, they're wonderful pepper because they have a very balanced sweetness, but they have heat, but not too much heat. So you can really slather it on. And
what do you put it on? I mean, I tend to use a spoon and take it out of the jar.
It's one of those things you can put on anything but ice cream, I suppose. But maybe even make
ice cream.
Ice cream.
Yeah, I think you could probably do that.
I mean, people put it on. My wife is the great lover of chili jam, and she puts it on cheese, puts it on all the meats, wonderful cheeses. She goes through about a jar a week, pretty consistently.
Now, hold on a second. Now, these are Fresno chilies.
Fresno chilies,
I mean, are they originally from California, and you just planted them?
Yeah, I'm sure they're originally from Fresno.
Okay.
We now have... The wonderful thing that's happened over the years is that we have so many local farms here in northern Michigan now who will grow things for us. And there's a farm just a couple miles down the road that grows most of the Fresnos for our chili jam now. And getting them fresh and at the perfect point is...
Hold on a second. This is an America that sort of didn't used to exist, but now it exists again. I mean, how do you manage to do this profitably? This is not inexpensive jam. This is not inexpensive whole grain mustard. But how do you manage to do it? What's the secret?
Well, that's a great question, Peter. And the truth is that it's because we do the opposite of what most of the large food companies do. instead of trying to put as little value as possible in every jar, we try to put as much value as possible into every jar so that we spoil our customers and create a long-term relationship. And because of that, 85% of our jars are sold, 85% of our sales are direct to our customers.
Really?
They go on the website, they go to our, we have 6 retail stores in resort towns in northern Michigan, and they go to the stores and they buy a case. And they pay retail price. And because of that, we can put the full value, you know, as much fruit, instead of putting a little bit of fruit in a jar, we're putting, you know, 65 to 80% of that jar is fruit. And it's a wonderful variety of fruit. And it's cooked in a small batch with great technique. And we can deliver more delicious food to our customers because we have this very fortunate business model.
Yeah, and people just love it so much, they don't care how much it costs.
Well, you know, I used to be a coward in terms of charging what I sometimes needed to charge. But my son, who is now the boss here, my 35-year-old son, has given me courage. And, you know, you can't deliver more value than the customer is willing to pay for. And our customers want the full value. They want wonderful products with, you know, great ingredients made in small batches. And we can only give them that if we charge what we have to charge. And no, people don't complain about the price. That's the amazing thing.
So just to give you an idea, listeners, a jar which contains, tell me afterwards how many ounces of whole seed mustard, retails for right around $13.
Right.
And it's become indispensable in our house. I can't eat sausages without it.
And you know, when you're buying local wine and really wonderful local wine, and you're soaking those most mustard seeds in that wine for a long time, you have to charge for that. And really, the proof is in whether or not people come back. If it's a good value, they will buy it again. And we have incredibly loyal customers. And you know, the world doesn't need another so-so mustard, and it doesn't need another, you know, so-so jam. It really, we kind of have to be so wonderful that people have to have it.
Well, you know, I might mention that your chili jam is a finalist in the Sophie Awards, which is the special, it's called the Oscars of the food world. I'm praying for you for the gold, because it certainly deserves it. There were how many entrants into the Sophie thing? It was like 2,500 or something.
Yes, there's thousands of entries.
Yes.
And so it's a great honor, and we're thrilled to have that. And, you know, our own customers here have loved this product, and so it's a great confirmation for them as well.
And you also have things such as, unsurprisingly, because I think Michigan is the main source of quality sour cherries in the country.
Right. We grow most of the Montmorency cherries in America, what's commonly known as the pie cherry.
Uh-huh.
And if you ever come out to northern Michigan, drive the Leelanau Peninsula in May, when the fruit trees, especially the cherry trees, are in bloom, it's one of the most beautiful sights in the world.
I'm frightened to open the jar of sour cherry jam because it'll be half empty before I put it back in the refrigerator.
And then the Red Haven peach preserves, you grow peaches there too?
There are wonderful peaches here grown on a farm owned by a farmer named Joe Daly, and he's grown these peaches for us for, you know, almost 30 years now. And the challenge is that it's a melting fresh variety of peach that was developed in Michigan in the 1940s. And we have to hand peel and hand pit 60,000 pounds of them every August. So we just shut down our kitchen. We bring in all the local people to help us that we can. And we, you know, we peel peaches. And it's quite an exhausting process, but it's the only way to get those wonderful chunks of this wonderful variety of peach, because it can't be live peeled, it can't be commercially peeled, it has to be done very carefully.
Well, it sounds like you have a good life.
You know, I really do. I feel very, very fortunate to be able to live in northern Michigan and make a living here. My son, Noah, who runs the company, has two children, so I have two grandchildren here in town. I can go out and forage whenever I want. I can ride my bike to work or ride my bike down to our downtown store. And it is really idyllic, and in fact, my wife is working at the cafe next to our store right now.
Hello, can I get on the list for these morels?
You know, I think they've become so popular. I don't know if I can do that anymore.
When I lived in Indianapolis, everybody had their private stash of where they got their mushrooms. And the morels. And I had one friend who had a party every year with them, but she went to her grave without telling anybody where this thing was.
No, you don't tell anyone where your morels are growing.
Oh, boy.
This is an amazing, it's sort of like Norman Rockwell meets the 21st century.
Yep.
And
we should be clear that anybody who was interested in the product should go on
spoon.com.
Spoon.com. That's going to be a regular on our watch here. We love your products.
Thank you, Ann.
Yeah.
And Peter.
So I'm talking to you makes me miss Michigan, actually. It was good.
Well, you know, it's a great time to visit, especially in July, when the lake's warm enough that you can jump into it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the lake the lake effect works year round to make this amazing microclimate that we're in. And I didn't even myself, summering here all those years, I didn't realize until I started to go out to the farms and see how they're sited and see how things grow here, how profound the lake effect is in creating this microclimate that we have. And it really is a very narrow band of land that's usually no more than 5 miles wide from the lakeshore to where the orchards are sited.
Well,
it sounds a little bit like heaven as long as you like your temperature a little chilly. Justin, once again, thank you so much for joining us on the menu today with your lovely story.
Thank you, Ann.
Thank you.
Great talking with you.
You too.
I guess we might have mentioned that one of the fascinating things about these products that we find is the fascinating stories, the really charming stories that lie beneath them.
Behind every product is a story, and that's kind of what fascinates us.
Right. So we just went.
We're fascinated today.
And there'll be, all right. And there'll be another story right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next story actually starts in Italy, although its latest iteration is a factory for pasta in Chelsea in Manhattan, in Chelsea, New York. But Giovanni Rana is the one who started the business, and we got to talk to his charming daughter, Antonella, and she presents the story, and also I can encourage you to try this pasta. I never thought that frozen filled pasta would make it on my really particular nitpicking Italian product range, but it's really to die for. So here we go, Rana pasta. Let's say ciao to Antonella Rana, who is going to be talking to us about her father-in-law's company. Giovanni Rana is his name, and we have loved his pasta for a long time. Now, Antonella, I thought that Giovanni was in Italy. making his pasta. Now, you tell us that there are different facilities now. Where is the pasta made and the sauces and the pesto in the United States?
We create a very special, let me call, kitchen. It's more than a facility. It's an amazing, big, huge kitchen, built on the love for freshness, and is in Chicago, Bartlett, Illinois.
Uh-huh. And you said you also have a restaurant is in Chelsea?
In Chelsea Market, downtown New York City. And again, is an amazing, big, open space restaurant. And we are so lucky that we have also room to produce our fresh pasta in-house every day. We are speaking about 1,000 pounds of fresh pasta per day.
Wow. Well,
that is nothing respect what they do, our friends in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
They do tons with the same love, just the quantity is bigger.
I see. I love Chelsea Market. I love it. And I love the pasta. Your specialty is fresh pasta stuffed with different things. Now, tell us what some of the products are.
In the Chelsea Market, with the workshop, with the production of the fresh pasta in real time, we share Giovanni Rana traditions and roots, and then we really do every kind of field pasta inspired by the market every day. But then what arrives in the kitchen can be an amazing case of zucchini, shrimp, or a special cheese. We have less or more 100 different kind of pasta.
Wow.
And also the dough can be very special. The dough can be red because we use tomato inside the dough. The dough can be green thanks to spinach. The dough can be black thanks to squid ink. And we really play, we really have a lot of fun mixing together tradition and innovation.
Oh, well, it is sold to us frozen. And so when you want to pull it out of the freezer, the cooking time is very little and it's very convenient.
Yeah, it's fully true. Our pasta is refrigerated, but when you buy from the fridge shelving, you can easily put in the freezer if you want.
Uh-huh.
And if you put in the freezer, when you take out, you don't have to change the time of cooking. You really have to follow the instructions. They are written on the package. We are speaking about a few minutes. Some products 3 minutes, some products 4, no more. And this is really important to me, because usually when someone cooks dry pasta, spaghetti, macaroni, mm-hmm. needs something has 8-10 minimum minutes. Also 13 if we are speaking about special shapes. But when we speak about refrigerated pasta, ravioli, tortellini, half moon, in that case, the time is super short.
Yes.
And it's really important checking.
It's what?
It's really important checking the time
when we throw
the pasta in the pot.
Right.
Yes. And we have to drain on time. If not, the texture will be a little bit ruined, and it's a shame because pasta texture is really important.
Now, explain to us, you're in the midst of the year of pesto. What does this mean?
The summer of pesto is a very important festival, let me call it this way. It's a sort of special activity that will last all the summer, and on our website you can find dozen and dozen different recipes to have fun with pesto. We are speaking about a very special, precious pesto, because all the basil, 100% of the basil that you have into the pesto is from Genova, Liguria.
Oh, really?
Then is imported by Italy, yes. And the pesto is so green, so fresh, so special, because we don't use any kind of preservative or artificial flavors or colors. Everything is 100% natural. We cut the basil, we wash, and we send to the United States by boat. And when the pesto basil arrive in Chicago, we mix with the cheese, with pine nuts, with extra virgin oil, always from Italy, and we prepare this jar for our American friends.
Now, why wouldn't you grow Genovese basil in the United States? I grow it.
This is a very good question, and I'm glad that you are asking me, because our policy is having the best ingredients from every single place from the world. For example, when I do a raviolo filled with lobster, I choose always lobster from Maine. But when I do a very traditional recipe from Italy, Liguria, based on basil, it's really important to us share with America our traditions and also our ingredients. The Ligurian basil is more sweet, and respect the American one doesn't have the specific note of mint that many times you find on the American or Mexican basil. And then we love the idea of using 100% Italian basil that is so sweet and fresh and special, and sharing with this amazing country our heritage.
Now, does the wheat that goes into the pasta, does that come from Italy also?
No. Again, speaking about the best ingredients, we buy the flour from North America, also from Canada, because we love the gluten that this kind of grain has. It's the best one to do the dough. The dough has to be flexible, has to be extendable. The dough is so important part of a raviolo, of a filled pasta. And then also in Italy, we use this North American flour.
Huh.
And again, when we speak about cheese, we speak about Parmigiano Reggiano,
right,
is only from Italy. But if we speak about ricotta cheese, we buy our ricotta in United States for United States pasta from Wisconsin, that you teach me that is the best place to have milk and ricotta in United States. This is our way to have friends in every place, because cooking, preparing food is a way to make friends.
Now, is this pasta a big seller in Italy as well, or is it mainly an export business?
No, it's an amazing seller also in Italy. We are leader over dozen and dozen of years. We started 53 years ago, and we are now leader not just in Italy, but also in Europe. Refrigerated filled pasta and fresh sauces are really our love, our mission, our call, because our desire is that every country has the best pasta if possible. And we are happy to share this kind of tradition. Ravioli, tagliatelle, pesto, basil, sauce are, let me say, treasures for our country. And that is also an honor, a reason of happiness, bring this kind of products around the world.
Now, just so that listeners understand, the original factory and the factories that supply most of Europe with pasta are all in the city of Verona?
Yes, sir. Then the pasta and the sauces that you buy in Italy and in Europe are made every day in Verona and other cities around Italy, Pavia, Milano. We have a lot of facilities because we do less or more 1 million bags, package of fresh pasta per day. You know that we buy in Italy 800,000 fresh egg every single day.
Wow.
So the quantity is huge, but also the quality is huge because we do every year 30,000 analyses into the lab, into the line of the production, because quality is our first point. It's a religion, quality.
How many chickens do you hire?
We have 1 million hen, chicken, to provide us every day 800 eggs. Because someone is lazy, someone doesn't do the egg every day.
Now, do the chickens all wear little shirts that say Rana on them?
Yeah, and it's really important to us because we ask to the different producer of the egg to feed our chicken in a very specific way to have the most healthy, natural, fresh egg as possible. And our research for quality is everywhere, in Italy, in Europe, in the United States. And we are so proud. We feed our kids, we feed our families with our products. It's our honor to use the best ingredients from every part of the world.
Well, now, here's a ringing endorsement for you as we close this interview. This is Peter, who knows practically nothing about cooking pasta, but the Rana products that come prepackaged, frozen, so that I can pop them in the freezer to keep and then pop them out to eat. I'm a fool, but it's totally foolproof.
I'm really happy that our pasta and our sauces are, let me say, your ally, your partner, your a friend in the kitchen. They really can be so useful. You can arrange a romantic date. You can surprise your family. You can prepare something for your kids. You can have a pasta party. Everything will be easy and super tasteful when you use Rana products. You can challenge me. Try every day, and I'm sure that our product will be really a strategic ally in your kitchen.
Well, you will be
the king, your wife will be the queen of the kitchen.
No, I will be the king.
I hope he's not the queen in the kitchen.
I will be the king of the kitchen, and our grandchildren are coming to visit in about 10 days. So I'm sure when I put Rana pasta on the table, they will be applauding a lot. And I will take all the credit.
But we are also happy if you say, I did it by myself. Yeah. I did it from scratch. We will be happy because it means that you really love. Don't worry about it. Take every honor. Okay?
Antonella, you're marvelous. You're just wonderful. And who could be a better spokesperson for this great product?
Thank you so much. And please, if you travel in Italy or in New York, stop by our kitchen. It will be a great pleasure hosting you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Our next guest is going to give you a lesson in business plan development as well. You won't believe how fast he came up with his company and his idea for a business. The company has one of those umbrella titles, mixed maids. So you can understand that he probably is going to have a lot more products in this food business of his. But to start with, we're going to be talking about the two that we've sampled. Bee's knees, which is, of course, honey, and tree's knees, which is, of course, syrup, maple syrup. Casey Elsass, you are an enigma. You started MixedMade.com, which is your website. Mixed Made, your company, on a single product, which was spicy honey. And then you expanded, and that was appropriately called Bee's Knees. And then you expanded 18 months later with a second product called Tree's Knees, which is not such an obvious name, which is maple honey and
maple syrup.
And maple syrup. Spice, chili, right?
Yeah, both are infused with chili.
What are you going to do next, I wonder?
Yeah, but he's planning on several more products, because you said you're not going to be at the Fancy Food Show this year because you'd rather put the money into developing new products.
That's right, yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. Is there a direction to this business? I'm not quite sure what it is.
Yeah, so actually our next product is going to be launched in the fall, either late September or early October. And it's going to keep in the theme that we've started so far. So it's going to have knees in the name. It's going to be spicy. And it's going to follow the same packaging aesthetic that we've started here. And then after that, that'll sort of round out 2015 for us. We've been on this journey of spicy condiments.
Uh-huh.
And after that, we have a few different directions we'd like to explore. I think we'll always return to this line as our baseline. We'd like to do some variations on each product, but I think from here, we're just going to start really going wild with lots of crazy ideas that we have. Maybe pick a theme every year and do a trio of condiments in that theme.
Uh-huh. So it's basically a condiment business.
I think so, but not strictly. We have some ideas that aren't condiments,
okay.
But every idea we have has to do with food.
And everything has to do with knees. Now I was thinking you could try something like something replacements. So you could do a mayo replacement. you think people would get the message?
It's a little obscure.
Now, when you do that, you owe me a few shillings.
Yeah, sure.
Now, Casey, your product tastes good, but I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do with it.
Well, we actually really encourage a lot of exploration. Our hashtag is great on anything, and that really holds true. The honey is so versatile. So it's great on eggs in the morning. It's great on biscuits or cornbread.
Yeah, that's
but
good.
It's also awesome as a dressing or a marinade. And I even put it on my ice cream. I love it in yogurt.
Yeah, that would be good.
It's sort of, yeah, I mean, think of it as a hot sauce and a honey, and it can be used in both ways. And then it's a similar idea with the maple syrup. We're really encouraging our customers to play around and use it in ways that are really going to surprise them. Like, we just did a recipe with the maple syrup for cedar plank salmon, and it's just the most perfect glaze on top of fish.
Oh, yeah, it would be great on salmon.
Here's a direction for you. Try baristas. Try both coffee producers and also cocktail makers.
Yeah, actually, we...
You've probably been doing that a little bit already. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, Grady's Cold Brew just came by today for some samples, and they're playing around with it because we've been hearing that iced coffee with spicy maple syrup is the ultimate.
Oh, that would be good, too, yeah. Well, it's certainly interesting. Maple, for some reason, has been having a moment. There's maple everywhere, and I don't know why. Do you?
Well, I'm from New Hampshire, so I've lived and breathed maple syrup all of my life. So if it's having a moment now, for me, it's always been part of my diet.
Yeah, we interviewed that woman who makes the maple cubes. What is her name? She has a charity as well. I can't remember what the name of the product is now.
Yeah, I used some of it the other day.
Tonewood.
It's only like 4 years old or something like that.
Tonewood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, look it up. She has great packaging. I think she was a publicist before she did maple syrup. Anyhow, you sort of just jumped into this. Your background's not in food, but you've always cooked, and you like the experimenting stuff, don't you?
Yeah, I grew up in a family that couldn't be bothered with recipes. We grew a lot of our own stuff in the backyard, so dinner time was always about sort of finding what we had on hand and improvising from there. So that's still the way that I cook. I use recipes as a reference point, but never when I'm cooking. Uh-huh. So when we started this business, it was exciting for me to have these two products, the spicy honey and the spicy maple syrup. I had never made them before. There's not really an instruction book on how to make these kind of products. So I just really went off on my own and started playing. And we started the business in 30 days, initially with the honey. So everything was very compact and very compressed, and we didn't have a lot of time to recipe test. So I tried out 7 different chili peppers. I tried a couple flavor infusions as well, and then we just mixed and matched. We invited some friends over and did a taste test and scored each type of honey on a scale of 1 to 10 in a bunch of different categories. And then from there, just kept moving on and picked the best combination and just ran with it. And then as we've grown and as my batches have been moved off of my stove and into a commercial kitchen, and now in our permanent space, it always changes a little bit. So I'm always still kind of playing around with the recipe.
You're going to expand your product line, but what are you doing about marketing?
In what way?
I mean, how do you market? I don't even know how I found you.
I think you saw us on Grub Street, maybe?
Oh, could be.
Yeah, so far we've been extremely press-driven.
Or Tasting Table, maybe, too.
Yeah, Tasting Table has written about us. We've had really, really great press. We were on the Today Show, MSNBC, and in Bon Appetit, Vanity Fair, Esquire. So we've had some really great press that's driven a lot of our sale and a lot of our expansion. But now that we're entering into our second year, we are starting to take the reins a little bit more on that. Press is great, but it's really unpredictable. So we've started entering into Facebook advertising. We have a pretty extensive email list, so we're really trying to be smart about how we use that and offer discounts and encourage gifting. And retail is our big, big goal for this year. We're aiming for 1,000 retailers by December. And we're on our way to it, so we're really looking to expand pretty rapidly.
Now, where can people find you now, Case?
Right now, we're in Whole Foods stores in the New York area.
Okay, that's a good start.
And outside of New York, we're targeting a lot of specialty shops, specialty grocers, cheese shops, that kind of place. But we're always open to new suggestions. I love when a customer emails and they've been in a store and thought, we should be in that store. Those are always the best connections to get.
Yeah, now, do you have a store finder on your website?
We don't. We're working on building one right now.
So, and the website is, just so people know?
Yeah, it's mixedmade.com.
Mixed, MIXEDMADE.
Yes.
Yep, that's right.
No mix up with milkmaids or anything like that.
No.
You might try that.
Well, you know, it's still a mystery to me. How did you know about scaling up and things like that when you have no background in this?
Well, two things. My partner, Morgan, had started a business before this one.
Okay.
So he had some experience, but not in food, which is a completely different thing. But a lot of it was just, as it grows, you're forced to learn and build and grow with it. And a lot of things are, well, so we started this in 30 days. So from the start, we've always held firm to this idea that it's better to take action than not to do something. So even if we don't make the right choice, we moved in the direction towards making the right choice, and we can go back and correct it. So we've certainly made some mistakes. We're very underprepared for our holiday, which was way more massive than we were expecting.
You were a little frantic at one point when I was communicating with you. So, Keith, where would you be able to get this now, these products?
We're in Whole Foods in the New York area. And then nationally, we're expanding into local grocery stores and cheese markets. And we're building a function on our site so users can enter their zip code and find their local spot.
And, and you love when people call and say your product should be in such and such a shop because it looked like it should be.
Yeah, those are some of my favorite emails to get. Sometimes people will be in their favorite local store and then think about our product and connect the two and then send us an email saying, you should be in the store, why don't you email them? And those are always the best connections to get.
So you're making lots of friends, Casey, huh?
Yeah, our customers are great. And I think because we're very interactive with them, we send out a lot of recipes and we're very active on social media, and we keep a pretty steady email presence. We get a lot of response back from them, which is always great. I love when people send me recipes or ideas on how they're using it. That's always really, it's just really fulfilling when you're making a product by hand to know that people are actually using it and appreciating it.
Well, you've gone through an enormous learning curve and produced a really wonderful product. And I think that the design of it is just amazing.
Thank you. Yeah. Our designer was our friend Rasmus Wixson, and we had some really wild, strange ideas of what we wanted. We were thinking like honey bears dipped in neon paint and just really tacky, terrible ideas that I'm glad we didn't end up doing. And Raz just came back to us with this idea of a very clean squeeze bottle with minimal logo. And his idea, actually, the chili pepper was his idea. And once we saw it, we just couldn't unsee that and just had to find a way to replicate that. And it wasn't easy. Those figuring out how to get a pepper in the bottle without affecting the flavor was tricky. And the shape of the bottle was tough to track down. That type of cap was difficult, but it was worth pursuing because we knew that's what we needed the product to look like.
Yeah, and it's going to be flexible enough for all these other products, and I can't wait for you to start rolling those out. So be sure to keep us posted on what you're working on. I know you're not going to tell me what's going to happen in the fall.
No, my lips are zipped.
So, but I'll find out, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, we've already started making it. I'll give you that clue. It takes a long time, so we've started making it now, and it's going to be ready in September or October.
Wow. Okay. Is it fermented?
No.
No. All right. Well, I'll wait to see, and thank you for taking time to talk to us about it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And we'll talk again soon. I mean, I've lots of things I'd like to chat with you about.
Great.
Okay. Ciao, Casey.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Our final guest today is a really generous-hearted young lady because not only did she figure out how to make the most luxurious gelato up to the top Epicure standards of Italy here in these United States, and she has a shop in New Hampshire and a shop in Boston, but she will also tell you in the book she's just completed how to make it for yourself. How about that for a deal?
Now, here's a book that you do not want to pick up if you're hungry. We're going to be talking to Morgan Murano, who is a gelato, what is the name?
The Murano Gelato of the business.
No, I mean the name for a gelato maker is...
Oh, gelataio.
Gelataio, like pizza, okay. And you have a book called The Art of Making Gelato, 50 Flavors to Make at Home. But there's a huge long story before this. Explain how you ended up learning all this about gelato.
Sure. Well, I grew up in the restaurant industry, My father was an entrepreneur, and so I always knew at a young age that I wanted to own my own business. And I went to college to study history and anthropology, even though I knew I wanted my own food-related business. And when I first studied abroad in Florence, I was exposed to Italian gelato and Italian food and culture, and it was one of the most amazing experiences I had ever had. And so as soon as I graduated from college, I enrolled in a culinary school in New York City, and I began working in as many kitchens as possible in New York City so that every single year for a period of 3 to 6 months, I would live in Italy and just explore the food there. And I fell into gelato making when I was exploring the outskirts of the city of Florence. I was actually looking for an apartment, and I saw a Sicilian gelato shop that was advertising, you know, their special of the day, which was granita. And I had never tried Sicilian granita before, and so I walked in and tried their pistachio granita whipped cream, and it was the most amazing dessert I've ever had in my life. And so I struck up a conversation with the owner there. His name is Antonio Caffarelli, and he was excited to know that I was an American, I had Sicilian heritage, and that I also had culinary experience. And so he wanted to see if I was interested in collaborating on a peanut butter flavored gelato, because he knows peanut butter is a popular flavor in America. And
the Italians don't eat peanut butter.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, at that point in time, there weren't many grocery stores in Florence that actually sold peanut butter. So I had to,
it was sort of like a scavenger hunt.
If I wanted to see what his kitchen looked like, I had to find this peanut butter so we could collaborate on a flavor. And in fact, he also wanted to learn how to make American cheesecake. I don't know why, but he was
very interested in
learning that. So a few days later, I arrived with peanut butter, and we collaborated on a flavor. And it wasn't until that day in the laboratory with him that I realized how amazing the gelato making process was. For me, I saw it just as an opportunity to learn something new, but it didn't really resonate with me until that day that I stood in that laboratory with him and I watched him whip together a base with peanut butter, and he had added the salt, and his laboratory was pristine. The gelato machine was unlike any other machine I'd ever seen to produce a frozen dessert, because I was used to just countertop batch freezers that you make in that you use in American kitchens. And so it really, really resonated with me, also because to a certain extent it's a lost art even in Italy.
Antonio
learned it from a gelato master chef, is what they call it in Sicily. And I really truly believe that Antonio is one of the few chefs in Florence that is making traditional artisan gelato, and he takes it very seriously. And it, you know, perhaps it was the history major in me, but it really resonated with me. It was also the fact that he's Sicilian. His shop sits on Cosimo Ridolfi Street, and my father's name was Cosimo. My great-grandfather's name was Cosimo. I think it was very fortuitous that I stumbled upon his shop and that he took me in and then began teaching me.
And the rest is history.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, before we get further into the my questions about the book, let's start with the basic question, the issue of how does gelato differ from ice cream is number one, and then how is it that the gelato that most Americans know, or as you say, even most Italians today, how does it differ from the artisanal, traditional Italian gelato?
Sure. Well, this is something we educate customers on in our stores, Murano Gelato, but the differences between American ice cream and Italian gelato are three primary differences. The first is butterfat content. Gelato is much lower in butterfat than American ice cream and generally falls under 10%, which is, whereas American ice cream is over 10%. The second difference is the density. Gelato is much denser than American ice cream. A lot of people think it's heavier as a result because it's so dense, but it actually is higher quality and lower in butterfat. And then the third difference is that gelato is served at a warmer temperature than American ice cream. And so these three things enable people to perceive the flavor of the gelato. That's why the gelato tastes even more intense, because butterfat coats your tongue, which coats your palate. The less butterfat enables the consumer, along with a warmer temperature, to taste the flavor right away instead of just perceiving a cold product and perhaps ice crystals. They perceive a smooth, warm, intensely flavored product, and to me that's why gelato is one of the best frozen desserts out there, and that's why I really am passionate about it.
Well, you have you have one shop, two shops?
Two shops. I started the first in Hanover, New Hampshire. However, it's been sold under a license agreement, so there are new owners there that are running it under the brand that I continue to own.
Now, you were basically looking for expansion of distribution, aren't you?
I'm undergoing a company expansion. So our second location now is in Chestnut Hill, the mall at Chestnut Hill, and I'm looking to do a quality-oriented expansion. I'm not looking to open hundreds, but I'd like to expose as many people as possible, as many communities as possible, to traditional Italian gelato. I think there's still a void in America, and I hope to fill that.
Now, you emphasize the requirement you just talked about, Antonio, how spotless his factory was, or his shop was. You're emphasizing how important sanitation is, and boy, we sure have seen recently what can happen without strict controls on that. Look at poor Jenny's, huh?
Yeah, no, it's true. I think a lot of things can happen. Even when, you know, you have a very clean kitchen and you're producing your product in a very clean way, there are things that are out of our control, like our ingredients. You know, our ingredients are produced in factories in Italy, in Europe, even locally, and there's risk of contamination that's beyond our control. So I'm not too familiar with what happened with Jenny's, but from what I understand, it was sort of out of their control now.
Yeah, but they closed their shops and then they reopened and they just now closed again. And they've destroyed billions pounds of product and lost that much in revenue as well. It's very sad. And it's
hard
to control.
In fact, especially because Jenny's has such a strong reputation.
It's so good.
Yeah, you know, I've never had it, but I've been wanting to have some shipped, but obviously at this point I'm sort of waiting to. So.
Yeah, well, I just sent her an email and asking, she has a new line of flavors. And just shortly after that, I got the news about the Listeria. So I don't think I'm going to see this. The new, it was based on Impressionist painters, the new line.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now, again, in this book, yours. What?
Go ahead.
If we can't actually get to your stores and we can't access your gelato, you can't order it online, right?
No, we do not offer the shipment of gelato online yet. I think this could potentially change, but when I created this business, I really wanted to try and put the stores in communities where people, sort of like in Italy when you go to the butcher to get your meat and you go to the fruit vendor to get your fruit.
Now start with, it's like in Italy when you go to the butcher.
Just as in Italy, when you go to the butcher or you go to the fruit vendor to buy fruit, I want customers in the community to come to us for gelato. And they can have their to-go containers packed right there on site with the flavors of their choice versus going to a supermarket and having it decided for them. They know that it's been made on site fresh that morning, and they can customize their to-go container right there. And so that's why we don't offer the shipment of our product. Again, this could eventually change as the business evolves, but it's the business model that I think works for us for now.
Well, in the meantime, you produced this book, which tells you everything you didn't know you needed to know about making gelato, right?
Yes.
Starting with the machines and equipment, you've tested everything and you know exactly what people should buy to produce good quality gelato?
Yes. Yeah, I was looking to give a comprehensive manual to those interested in making gelato at home. Over the years, we've had a lot of customers ask me for recipes because they wanted to try and recreate, you know, some of the flavors at home. And it was the perfect opportunity to write this book last year. I had a little more free time, and I tested every single recipe out, and it's very much so traditional flavors. And you can even make it in a regular American ice cream, you know, machine. That will work as well.
So you do gelato, and you do a step-by-step production guide. You do a sorbetto. Step by step, and then you do 50 flavors.
Yes.
And now, how many of these are traditional? I mean, sweet milk is.
Yes. Well, some of them, at Murano Gelato, we do strictly traditional flavors, but then on certain American holidays, we have a little fun and make American flavors. And so some of the flavors in the book, are the highlight, you know, these different recipes we've developed over the years for American holidays. So we have a donut and an apple pie recipe in the book, an avocado recipe that we make on Cinco de Mayo.
Yeah, that didn't seem like it was traditional.
Yeah, that's not traditional. But, it was also to give our customers, our loyal fans, an opportunity to recreate some of their favorite recipes at home and or their favorite flavors at home. And in fact, avocado and donut and apple pie are pretty popular when we make them.
Right.
And we only make them once a year, so.
Uh-huh. How much time are we talking about in making? You said you'd like to get into the shop early so that you can actually have it ready, finished, and ready to serve by afternoon.
Yes. Yeah, so we usually begin production anywhere between 6:30 and 7:30 in the morning, which isn't that early compared to a lot of bakers. But we, you know, depending on the day, we usually start between 6:30 and 7:30 a.m., and then we finish by 2 p.m.
Right. Now, what takes the most time, the freezing?
Well, it's not actually the process itself. Every batch takes from start to finish about 20 minutes. It's the fact that we make 12 different flavors in our Chestnut Hill location and 16 in our Hanover, New Hampshire location.
Wow.
And so you can't just make one batch of each flavor. You know, naturally during our busy season, we go through multiple batches of chocolate. So I think that's what takes the most time, is the fact that you're not just producing one batch of chocolate, you're producing four batches of chocolate. You know, and then obviously after production, we have a lot of fruit that we need to peel and cut, you know, lemons and grapefruits and limes to juice. So there's a lot of prep involved in making the gelato as well.
Right. You have kiwi in here?
Yes. That's a great flavor.
Yeah. And strawberry, sorbetto syrup. You have the recipe for that. So you think that it's perfectly possible for anybody buying this book to go home, buy some equipment, and start making gelato?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, in fact, there's quite a few people that have tried the recipes and love the fact that they're a lighter base, versus some gelato recipes out there on the Internet that really are more like American ice cream, but they call it gelato, whereas this is, you know, to a certain extent, it highlights the science of gelato, where you have the liquids and the solids coming together to create a base that is less in butterfat than American ice cream, but still can be made in an ice cream maker at home. I think what's really important for readers to know, for those who are interested in making the recipes at home, is that the idea behind these recipes is the same that we have in our stores, which is that you make it and you eat it within 24 hours, because in my opinion, the gelato is best within that time frame. If you let it sit in your freezer at home, which is set to a much colder temperature, it's just going to continue to harden. And, again, it's made for those who are interested in producing it and consuming it within 24 hours.
Well, I mean, I hope this starts a homemade gelato trend in a big way. And good luck with you on your business development. You sound like you know what you're doing.
Thank Thank you.
Morgan, it was wonderful talking to you.
Same here, Ann.
Thank you.
We're so glad you joined us today. We hope you found these stories as interesting as we did, and we'll hope you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.